On the record. On News Talk.
With Pinergy. Supplying energy with insight to forward-thinking Irish businesses.
If you did watch Ireland's World Cup qualifier last night, you may have tuned in early enough to see what was a piece that was probably better than the actual match itself. Some archive footage of the last meeting between the Republic of Ireland and Luxembourg. It was in a very, very different Lansdowne Road. Now, that old Lansdowne Road Stadium, as is the case with Dalymount Park on the north side, the previous home of Irish football, it was once partly the work of a very famous stadium designer called Archibald Leitch. He designed stands, he designed entire grounds. In fact, he pretty much, Donal Fallon, more or less invented the modern stadium as we know it, didn't he?
He did. And you know what? After last night, I think we'll retreat into the safety of football's past and not its present or future.
Because football past is probably a happier place for Republic of Ireland fans to be spending the next couple of years right now. That brief historic nod last night was probably really all there was to enjoy, really, about last night's coverage.
There was. I mean, there was very little inspiring about last night's clash. And I have great faith, I want to say, on the record, I have great faith in Stephen Kenny and great admiration for him. But the game itself had all the momentum and energy of a friendly, you know, and not a World Cup qualifier. Mm. But, you know, one thing I miss, even on bad nights like that, give me the worst Irish performance in history, if I can be there watching it, you know, is the walk to Lansdowne Road and the buzz that kind of descends on Ringsend, Beggar's Bush, and the local area on a match night. And I just think that the stadium today, there's, you know, those beautiful views as you approach Lansdowne Road, the manner, and it will always be Lansdowne Road to me, by the way, but the manner in which, you know, the beautiful curved roof of the smaller stand behind the goal kind of ensures that the stadium and the houses around it aren't in conflict. I think the stadium is an architectural masterclass. It's one of the finest stadiums in Europe and beyond. And anything Scott Tallon Walker do is excellent. And I just think it's a gem, that stadium. But despite that, there's still a nostalgia that will never fade, really, for the Lansdowne Road of old. And at least in part, that stadium is attributed to Archibald Leitch. It was the hard work of the great Henry Dunlop that made it happen. Dunlop is really a pioneering figure, maybe the pioneering figure in Irish rugby, founder of the Lansdowne Football Club. But Archibald Leitch, you know, is the father of the modern association football stadium. And just before we came on air, we were chatting. You said, oh, you're aware of his connection to Old Trafford.
Yeah.
He's someone that's very synonymous with British football stadiums. But as we'll learn today, you know, he's at the heart of some of the most important Irish ones as well.
Yeah, this is what I was struck by, because when I'd heard the name before, I only knew it in association with the earliest incarnations of Old Trafford and some of the first grandstands and the scoreboard end and all of the old, you know, the pre-1990s innovations at Old Trafford. But I didn't realise that the extent of his stadiums was so remarkable, and it's all over these islands.
Oh, look, Anfield, Hampden Park, Goodison Park, Craven Cottage. Craven Cottage, as we'll get into later, probably the one that still looks most like it did in Leitch's time. Old Trafford, Villa Park, Ibrox. I mean, that is a very, very small selection of grounds that once, you know, bore the hallmarks of Archibald Leitch. And at his peak in the 1920s, it was estimated that 16 of the 22 clubs in England's First Division had employed Leitch and his firm to assist in stadium and stand construction. So, you know, when we think about Scotland's influence on association football off the pitch, I think what comes to mind immediately is an incredible managerial legacy Scotland. You know, among others, Bill Shankly, Alex Ferguson.
Yeah, Jock Stein.
Kind of a more forgotten Scottish name off the pitch is definitely that of Archibald Leitch.
And he comes across and he comes about at a very interesting time, because football was having this really meteoric rise. And then people get into the game, but they have to figure out how to try and commercialise it and to bring crowds in and have them enjoy it safely.
Absolutely. I mean, the rapid rise of association football, as they called it, or soccer to me and you, in these islands in the late 19th century, it's really transformative, in not only in people's lives, in that people are playing it, but in terms of, you know, leisure, in that people have the time to go and watch it. And in Ireland, it's a businessman called John McCallery, Irish sporting lore has it. He's from Belfast. He actually encounters a game of football while he's on honeymoon in Scotland. Mm. And he likes it so much, he kind of brings the game back to Belfast. And he organises the first kind of competitive matches there, and he forms Cliftonville Football Club, which originally a bit of cricket club, which is kind of strange. But there's a big crossover in the late 19th, early 20th centuries where cricket clubs are throwing their lot in with this kind of new, interesting gentleman's game.
Yeah, God love John McAleary's wife as well, because the first person ever to sacrifice their husband, or the first person ever to have sacrificed their honeymoon to someone else watching a game of football. God love her.
Absolutely. And football's kind of emergence, it coincides with, you know, the emergence of a very radical new idea, which people couldn't really get their heads around, which was time off work, you know, and you have a booming leisure industry. So that manifested itself in all kinds of ways. You know, the English went to Brighton, we went to Bray, but there was the explosion of things like popular theatre, spectator sports. So it wasn't enough to, you know, let people in to watch matches. And no longer were people watching, you know, footballs being kicked around public parks. You had to build stadiums. You had to have somewhere for spectators to sit or terraces to stand on. And, you know, stadiums are basically constructed with that in mind, moving the game from the public park into a commercial space of leisure and enjoyment.
Yeah, the other thing that really instigated all of that as well was the development of railways in the second half of the 19th century, because then suddenly it became possible for you to have a sports team that could possibly jump on a train, go off and play somewhere else, and then get back again and have the whole thing done on the same day, which really just managed to be a lightning rod for the whole thing. Leach, as you mentioned, he began in the business of building factories, though, rather than stadiums.
He's born in Glasgow, 1865. And I mean, Glasgow was about as different from Dublin as a city could be in the 19th century. I mean, it had experienced the Industrial Revolution. And you still see that, you know, when you look at the urban landscape of Glasgow, the chimneys, the 19th century red brick that's absolutely everywhere. And Archibald Leach, you know, studies to be an architect and builds factories, which, you know, is not the most exciting thing to be building, but they need them, and they need them in abundance. Mm. So in the colonies and you know, then across Britain, building factories and elected to the Institution of Engineers and Shipbuilders in Scotland, which is pretty prestigious stuff. But the first stadium that he's commissioned to work on is Ibrox for his boyhood heroes, Glasgow Rangers. In fact, he initially refused any payment because he's a Rangers fan, which is remarkable. And his biographer, Simon Inglis, I don't know why it took someone so long to write a biography of the father of modern football stadiums, but Simon, a real authority on football history, eventually did it. And the point that he makes is so true. He says, designing factories was one thing. Factories had been around for decades. Building a football ground for 80,000 spectators was quite another challenge. There were few precedents.
Yeah.
Most football grounds of the period just sort of grew, stand by stand, terrace by terrace. At best, a would-be stand designer could pick up a few design tips from theatres and music halls. So no one had really done this before. This was page one, chapter one. And arguably, Ibrox in Glasgow is the first modern football stadium in Britain, and it's Leach who designs it.
Yeah, it's worth actually just dwelling on that point for just a second, the idea that there just wasn't any kind of external or internal place where you'd have to gather that many people before. So all there were, when there was gatherings, there were people on streets all looking upwards from the same vantage point, but you never had to accommodate 80,000 people or even 10,000 people basically sitting around in and out there things. So it was a totally brand new branch of architecture. Rangers, you mentioned there, Leach's favourite boyhood club, they're very humble beginnings, which is not unlike some of the Dublin clubs who also began their days in public parks.
They played their first match on Glasgow Green, which basically is the Phoenix Park, you know, and then they played in a cricket ground, which didn't really work either. So that was untenable, you know, and as the game was rising, people in Rangers were saying, look, we need a ground. Mm. So Ibrox kind of emerges from these needs. And, you know, it was defined really by these very, very large terracing. And that point really can't be overemphasized. It is, as we would not recognize it, the first football stadium we'd understand. But there were dangers in this. I mean, no one had done this before. So 68,000 people pack into Ibrox, April 1902, for England and Scotland. A section of the terracing, to quote a newspaper, collapses like a trap door and 25 people are killed. So that demonstrated the dangers of these new grounds, you know, large wooden stands, their inability to hold large crowds.
But funnily enough, though, the blame, sorry, I shouldn't say funnily enough because it's a very tragic incident, obviously, but the blame doesn't actually lie with the stand itself for that tragedy, or rather lie with the designer.
I think it's fair to say the tragedy in that case, or the blame in that case, is very much with the builders, because they used kind of substandard pine. They charged Rangers for the best stuff and they didn't use it in the end. And, you know, by no means that was the last such tragedy in a British football stadium. Mm. But, you know, as one biographer has put it, the result was a patented form of terracing, which is formed by solid ground, effectively earth banks, to make them stronger. Following the Ibrox disaster, wooden frameworks and steel frames were discredited and replaced throughout the United Kingdom by his new reinforced terracing. So Leach totally changes his approach to, you know, what constitutes safe standing after that disaster. But even today, when you look at Ibrox, and I've been there actually, I've been in the away section, not the home section, surprise, surprise. But, you know, when you approach Ibrox, the beautiful red brick kind of shell of Leach's stadium is still there. And the exterior of Ibrox is really so at odds with the modern stadium that's on the other side. But it's a really nice architectural nod that they've kept that. And it does look like, it looks like a factory on the horizon as you approach Ibrox. So there was real emotional importance, I think, for Leach in building the stadium of his boyhood heroes.
I suspect that red brick link is something that we might come back to again in a few minutes' time. His influence in Ireland isn't just seen in the south, as we mentioned with Dalyman Park as well, but it's also visible in the north, but yet it's probably fair to say that it's nowhere more visible than in Phibsborough.
Yeah, he built stadiums in both Belfast and Dublin. Windsor Park in Belfast, which is home to Linfield, and where the Northern Irish team play. Mm. And in Dublin, there's definitely some connection. Simon gets into this. It's an unclear connection, but there's definitely Leitch connections to Lansdowne. But Dalyman Park, I mean, is really where you can, even today, kind of get a sense of Leitch as an architect in terms of the layout of the ground and the dominance of terracing there. And it's one of the really iconic football stadiums in these islands. And when you stand there now, I mean, there's the Jodie stand. I was going to say the new Jodie stand, no longer new.
It's not new anymore,
It's replaced the Leitch stand. But Dalyman still maintains the feel of a classic, and dare I say it, British football stadium, you know, of the early 20th century. Mm. And, you know, despite the amendments that have been made and the beautiful floodlights from, I think, the 50s, it still attracts football tourists. You know, if you're ever at a match in Dalyman Park, you meet Germans, Italians, Spaniards, football mad people that are drawn to just see that stadium because of the sense of history that it carries. And the first game that was played there, actually, in Leitch's ground was Bohemians and Shelburne. 5,000 people packed in for that. And now they're actually going to share that ground. So it's becoming something new, a new chapter in its life. But I think what's remarkable about Archibald Leitch's Dalyman Park is how long it lasts. And people talk about the game with Italy in the mid-80s, I think 85. You see pictures of people standing on the roof of the stand. Mm. Liam Brady remembered basically jumping over spectators' legs running down the touchline. There's that many people in the ground running down the sideline. But I think that was the turning point. I think they realised by the 1980s that, you know, it was probably time to go, and that a beautiful stadium of the early 1900s, you know, wasn't going to make it into the 1990s without kind of drastic change.
Yeah, of course, it was probably that prompted that Italy friendly, which is what, or Italy competitive, whether it was a friendly or competitive match, I don't know. But either way, that Italian fixture, the one where you mentioned Liam Brady, was the prompt for Irish soccer then to move southside to Lansdowne Road, which is an interesting jumping off point, because beyond the terraces, there's another sort of a hallmark of some of Leitch's designs, which are some of the cottages, the changing rooms of old.
Yeah, they're beautiful things, aren't they? I mean, terraces kind of dominate the stadiums, because, I mean, the terrace is a way, one, for people to get in economically, but two, for the club to benefit from getting as many people as possible in. So, I mean, if you wanted a large working-class support base, terraces were everything. But, the gold standard of grounds by Leitch is Craven Cottage, Fulham's ground, where he installs kind of crush barriers, and they will become really synonymous with football grounds across Britain. And the style of barrier that he brings into the terraces, he patents them, so it's the Archibald Leitch crush barrier.
Okay.
And when you look at the stand and the beautiful little adjoining cottage at Fulham's Craven Cottage ground, they are both now Grade 2 listed buildings. So in 2002, Fulham found themselves in this weird moment where the Premier League quality requirements meant they had to move into Loftus Road, the home of QPR, and the hardcore Fulham support were absolutely furious. There was a boycott by some, there was a protest. And eventually, you know, to the tune of more than £5 million, they were able to go back to Craven Cottage with some new features, but they kept what they called of Leitch's ground. So that beautiful pavilion cottage is still there, and you catch a glimpse of it when Fulham are playing. It's so out of sync with the modern football ground, but it remains.
Yeah, I do also think it's a dreadful shame that with the redevelopment of, you might not call it that, but I would call it the Aviva Stadium, because, you know, naming rights pay for something, that the old Wanderers Cottage didn't get to survive the whole redevelopment, because it was just a gorgeous little spot, and it was so nice to have the cottage just poking out in the middle of the end of one of the main stands. Decades after Leitch's death, there was this tragedy, unfortunately, and perhaps somewhat ironically, it sort of marked the end for what was left of his remaining terraces.
Leitch dies in 1939, and it's really decades later, yeah, when you know, you get this great challenge to his legacy and the appearance of football grounds, the Taylor Report into the causes of the Hillsborough disaster in April 1989. I mean, there was a lot to digest in the Taylor Report, and it kind of rightly concluded that although there were other causes, the main reason for the disaster was the failure of police control. Like, it's a word for word quote from the report. Now, that disastrous tragedy, Hillsborough, I think it was a tinderbox of multiple things: unsafe capacity, poor policing. But it meant that in the optics of it, and in the way it all played out afterwards in the press, people didn't talk about overcrowding. People talked about terraces. And terraces were really in big, big trouble. And there was a move towards kind of all-seater stadiums. But thankfully, I think in recent years, football clubs in Britain are kind of coming around to the idea that there could be safe terracing. So at Celtic Park, you have a rail seating area with the north curve, very noisy corner of the ground where the Green Brigade are, which is basically safe standing. And the Bundesliga, I love when you watch German football on television, you get a real sense that, you know, that culture is still there too.
Yes, yeah, when you see the likes of the Yellow Wall at Dortmund or something, and they just have these masses of people.
It's incredible. And when it's properly regulated with the right planning, the right crowd control, it's totally possible to have standing in our stadiums. And in the domestic league, I mean, again, I think it's something that draws football tourists to Ireland. It's mostly survived. But even where it hasn't, you know, for example, the Tallaght Stadium is four stands around the pitch. Some sections stand anyway. I mean, I think it's a legacy of times past. Yeah. It's just a cultural thing as much as anything, that Irish football fans were raised on the idea of the terrace. But seeing that footage last night before the match of people standing in Lansdowne Road, it was like a throwback to a different world.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that safe standing idea. Basically, for people who aren't aware of it, the idea is that it's basically the same space that would usually be assigned to bucket seats, so that when you get your ticket, you are assigned basically to what would be a seat, except the seat just isn't physically there. So you kind of have this allotted spot where you're allowed to stand. And the idea is that you're able to control the attendances. And it does seem to work in the areas in Britain that they've trialled it. So fingers crossed it's able to make something of a comeback. There are traces of Leach's work that are still remaining today, despite the whole-scale modernisation of football, but also including in some museums as well.
Yes, Simon Inglis, his biographer, has done a lot to kind of restore him to consciousness to the football public in Britain. And I hope Simon's book will be republished soon. It's a great book. But Simon actually saved two of his terrace barriers, which is incredible. Historians pick up the weirdest things on their journey through life. Yeah. And one of them is in the National Football Museum, which is one of the great museums, the great social history museums in Manchester. A really amazing place to just get lost for a couple of hours. And another, fittingly, is in the Scottish Football Museum at Hampden Park. So it's a nice little tribute to Leach. But, you know, football grounds, they have to change and they have to evolve, of course, whether we like it or not. And while some of them have museums, they are ultimately not museums. You know, it's not the job of Old Trafford or Ibrox or Celtic Park or even Dalymount Park to exist as a museum space. Mm. They have to be cutting edge. They have to be modern facilities. So that leaves the big question, what do you do with the heritage? But I think what Rangers and Fulham and other clubs have shown is that you can, if you really try and think, if you think about it, you can incorporate the old into the new. And I think the surviving red bricks, you know, at places like Ibrox and Craven Cottage, they're a great little tribute to Archibald Leach in their own way, even if he wouldn't recognise the game today on or off the pitch.
Even if he wouldn't be surprised by the idea of Mighty Luxembourg coming to Dublin and claiming a scalp. Hopefully we'll get our revenge when we go back to Luxembourg City in a couple of months. I'm sure we will. Not quite so sure that we will at all.
Three brothers on the one team. Incredible.
Yeah, well, yeah, hopefully we can find some other clan of brothers who can make it through to the senior squad and maybe score some goals while they're at it. Donal, we will leave you before we get too depressed about the state of modern football or modern architecture. Thank you very much as ever, Donal Fallon, historian, author of the Come Here To Be books and presenter of the Three Castles Burning podcast on Dublin history, which you'll find anywhere you get your podcasts.
On the record, on Newstalk,
with Pinergy, supplying energy with insight to forward-thinking Irish businesses.